We actually have gotten up to about the 400s. We're going to retread it just a little bit to do some setting for those who weren't a part of that conversation. But we were pretty much at the end of, we were talking about Theotokos, the idea of whether Mary is the God-bearer or not. And the church is going to kind of go crazy trying to figure out, does Mary give birth to God? And if you say no to that, what does that mean? If you say yes to that, what does that mean? And so that's one of the struggles in the 400s. But we'll retread here. I have some run-up. If you don't talk and share and ask questions and all that stuff, I always over-prepare for these things. So we can go back a little ways, or we can go back really far. I'm not even quite sure how far back I want to go just yet. But my thought today is we would spend a big chunk of time on Augustine. There is, or Augustine, however you want to say it, it doesn't really matter. There is no theologian in church history, probably outside of Paul, that has had a greater amount of impact on Christian theology. And he's such a pivotal character for a couple reasons. For one, it happens to be when he lives. So he's born in the middle 300s, he lives to 430. This is right after Nicaea. This is the first council that the churches convene together, is the time when Augustine is born. And then he's going to live over the time of Constantine, right? So when the emperor becomes a Christian to the extent that he's a Christian, he's in the first years of this whole thing. And then he's actually going to be, Augustine is dying in the city of Hippo that has been surrounded by the barbarians. So he's reading the Psalms as his city is besieged. And so he is alive at the fall of the Roman Empire, essentially. And so just this kind of pivotal time that he plays. So he's important for that reason, but he's also important. So he's a divided man. We have the East and the West Church. The East Church is going to become what's called the Orthodox Church, whether it's Russian Orthodox or Greek Orthodox Church, or however you understand the Orthodox Church. It founded its kind of home base in Constantinople. The West Church is going to be the Roman Catholic Church, and all of us who kind of splinter away from the Roman Catholic Church over time. And Augustine is kind of this watershed moment. What is a watershed?
Where everything flows to.
So, like, from this point on, so we're on the mountain, right? And if this is a watershed moment, things on this side go that way into that body of water. And things on this side go that way into that body of water. This is really kind of Augustine. He's going to be the number one influential theologian in the West, and in the East he plays no role in the theology at all. They have no place for Augustine. And so it's like he's really this hugely pivotal character for us in the West, plays no role in the East at all. In the last maybe 100 to 200 years, Eastern Orthodox theologians were starting to talk the way they talk about sacraments. They were starting to sound very Roman Catholic. And some of their younger theologians are saying, hey, listen, if you go down that road, you're going down that road because you're basing all of this on what Augustine thought. We have never followed Augustine on these matters. And so even though there was this trickling towards Augustine about 100 years ago or so, there's been this swing back to like, nope, that's not us. Thank you very much. So the stuff that he went through is amazing. The stuff that, so we could really do 8 weeks on Augustine, basically. I don't know that we'll do that. But yeah, so let's.
Rob, so I'm curious when we study church history that we can be studying the development of the church. But at what point did Christianity become like well known? You know, like people have heard of the Mormons, but as you go farther out, they're not thought of as a world religion. And
right.
When did Christianity kind of grow to a point where maybe it would make that status?
So we know around the time of its founding, so Jesus, right around 40 AD, the Roman Empire is about 60 million people. If you read the book of Acts, in its early state, we're talking about a few thousand max. By 300, the estimates of the church, that there are 6 million Christians in this 60 million population empire. So we've become 1 out of 10 in less than 300 years. Exactly what, but it seemed, the amazing thing is, we can track the growth in connection to persecution. And that's something that we in the West, in the American church, don't want to think about. Why is the American church struggling? Maybe it's because we don't suffer enough. I mean, we hear the words from Zambia. The struggle there. I read just yesterday, because of the panic of the coronavirus, there's a toilet paper shortage in Hawaii already. People are stocking up, hoarding this stuff. But think of, like, our problems are toilet paper problems. Not whether it's safe to go home or not. We don't, it's not the world that we live in. So the really explosive growth, the exponential growth happened during huge times of persecution.
During that time period, what was going on in China and Asia as far as the different religions?
So I'm not an expert in those. They are growing, but we are also seeing the church reaching out. So to this day, the church in India says that it was established by Thomas. Whether that is true or not, we don't know. But it attributes its the line of Christianity that came to it from Thomas. So they're assuming that that's correct, which is an assumption. We have within the apostles' time Christianity going far, I mean, to the uttermost parts of the earth. Really, we're upon St. Patrick, right? St. Patrick's Day. What? 300-400s, we have missionaries going to Ireland to these strange Celtic people. We have Columbus, 100 years later, going to the Scots. I'm not a world religion expert. I hardly would have already said more than I know. So,
to pick up on the idea of church growth, is your first question. Wasn't Constantine a major player in the growth of the church? Do I hear that?
Yes and no. So if you're looking just at numbers, he's obviously going to be. So Constantine, those of you who don't know, so the emperor is Constantine. Let me go to, this kind of gets us here. So Diocletian is kind of the first, he's an emperor of Rome. He's like the first major empire-wide persecution of Christians. This is an amazing thing, I should have gotten a picture of it. We actually have passes. So you had to get permission proving that you had sacrificed to the idols, or else you could lose your job, you could lose your life, you could lose your property. They have actually preserved must be animal skin, because paper would have lasted that long, but we have copies of passes, essentially, proving sacrificing to the gods. Diocletian is the first to say, you just have to do this. He was actually after the unity of the empire. He wasn't actually trying to kill Christians. That was just kind of how he went about it. So I want you to conform. And if you won't conform, then we're going to have problems. But it ends up for Christians being great persecution. So 303 is the great persecution. Galerius is a general under Diocletian. He's the one that's kind of really after all this. Galerius is going to be who Constantine goes up against in this civil war that's happening in the empire. There are several different regional factions that occur. And so Constantine is ruling in the east, and he's kind of expanding his territory. He goes against Galerius, and he has this vision at the Milvian Bridge of the Cairo. So if you ever see, those are the first two letters in Greek for the word Christ, Christos. The X is CH and that's Rho, the P is Rho for Christ. So he had this image and under this symbol conquer. And he ends up winning this battle. So is Constantine a Christian? Is he not a Christian? People love to argue about that. But his first major act is in 312. He issues what's called the Edict, or 311, the Edict of Toleration. You can't just lose your property because you're a Christian anymore. You can't just be thrown in jail simply because the name, or you could just a few years prior. 313 is the Edict of Milan, which recognizes Christianity as one of the official religions of the empire. So now it's fair game to actually be worshiping as a Christian. So as things go along, it's often attributed to Constantine. It's really the guys who follow Constantine. So the guy, so we have Constantine. He dies in 337. He's on the move to making the empire Christian. The guy, one of the guys after him, though, Justin the Apostate is his name. What a great name, you know. The pagan, Justin the pagan. Justin is convinced that the problems that we're seeing in Rome, i.e. the barbarian hordes that keep attacking us, we feel threatened all the time. Rome was only strong when it was expanding, getting territory, getting money, and when it starts constricting, it's in trouble. The trouble we're having here in the Roman Empire clearly must be these Christians. The gods have to be upset. Because when we were worshiping these other gods, things were going well. We kind of turned this corner and started worshiping this Christian god. These other gods are suffering. Their temples are in disrepute. I mean, Constantine is giving pagan temples to Christians to use in worship. Constantine is underwriting financially with the money of the state, the funds that would go to pay priests. So he's underwriting the church financially. Justin comes along and says, this is terrible. We've got to get rid of this. And so he tries to turn everything on its head and go, we're going to go back to pagan ways. So 367, that's happening. The guy after him is Theodosius I. He is kind of like Constantine on steroids. If you are going to do business in the empire, you're going to be a Christian. What that now means is that the church gets to decide who has a business license. So if I'm the pastor, or if I'm the bishop, and you don't give enough money, or you tick me off, or something like that, I'm going to excommunicate you, and you're going to lose your business. So who then is, let's take the sign-up sheet around. Who would like to be a Christian? So when you go that way, do the numbers increase after Constantine? Yes. But are these nominal Christians that are, this is what you do to be a good citizen of the empire? It gets to the point where Theodosius II, who's going to rule into the 430s, he goes right after, my mind just goes all over the place. But he goes to 432, with 432, it's the Edict of Theodosius. He goes worse. You cannot, everyone in the military must be a Christian. Everyone in public service must be a Christian. There's a beginning to outlaw Jewish proselytizing. Jews are not allowed to try to convert people. So everybody is going to be a Christian, even if they're secretly a pagan, a secularist, a Jew, whatever. So that's the danger always of the numbers, is because does it look like the growth continues under Constantine? Yes, it does, but it's because it's almost peer pressure and non-peer pressure, and people above supreme pressure. So, yeah, it's true, but it's a yes, but kind of a thing.
So it was a reverse persecution.
It really was. Yeah. By the time we get to Theodosius II, there really is a reverse persecution that's going on. An example would be under Theodosius II, a Jewish person was not even allowed to buy slaves. So you could inherit one, but you couldn't get any more. And the reason was because you were still allowed to proselytize, to try to convert your slaves. But the way they got around that is to say, well, Jews can't have any more slaves. It was really a form of population control. We're going to control how big these religions get by controlling how big these religions, how many people actually are in these religions. So there's very significant, subtle forms of persecution that are going on. And some of it comes back to Augustine, unfortunately. I mean, he talks about the abominable rituals that some different sects are doing. The one thought I was starting to go down, but I stopped myself. So Augustine is 430 is when he dies. Theodosius II is issuing this stuff in 432. I wonder, was the only thing keeping Theodosius from going off the rails the way he did was Augustine was still around. Like, there was this still significant figure who probably wouldn't have been that crazy about some of this stuff. Having said that, eventually I want to talk about Augustine's approach to the Donatists. I don't want to do that right now. I was going to, but I don't want to do that. This issue has to do with all of this stuff also.
Not being here in 100 when we covered...
They weren't here.
They weren't here. One of the ways that Christianity made an impact in the Roman Empire was the way they cared for the childless, the sacrifices of child and everything. Compared to that growth of Christianity early on with the church, when Constantine, it seems like you got to be a Christian to survive. Do you know the difference of the impact of the society during this time?
Yeah, I mean, so someone that has an electronic device, if you could do a Google search real quick for Justin the Apostate and hospitable, or hospitality. If you do a search for those, we'll get a really good quote. Don't act like you don't have electronic devices. A bunch of Amish people sitting there looking at me. What's an electronic device, bro?
Actually, our Amish friends had them before we did.
Well, you're excused that. Do you have anything, Matt? Justin, the Apostate, hospitality. Just those three words.
We get a LinkedIn guy who can put in hospitality behind Justin the Apostate. So.
And you also get Justin Timberlake. Hospitality group.
It's Justin. I'm sorry, it is Julia. There's a J word and a U. Give me a break. Five letters.
Is it still the Apostate?
Yes.
Okay.
And hospitality is still.
No, remember, it has Julian the Apostate by the Christian Church. All right.
Sorry.
That's all right. No, we're here. I have like 75. I'm not worried about how far we get into this. But. There's a quote that will come up.
All right.
Let all guess.
Give me a little more.
Let all guests who arrive be received by
no.
Christ.
No.
Here, how about this one? Let all people live in harmony. Men should be taught and wanted by reason, not by blows, insults, and corporal punishments. Those who are in the wrong in matters of supreme importance are objects of pity rather than of hate.
That's good, but no, that wasn't what I meant. There's a place when Justin, he's writing a letter to a high priest. His name starts with an A, and I'm not even going to try to guess because I'd be wrong since I didn't get Julian Justin right anyhow. But what he says is, he's telling, if this thing, this reconversion to paganism is going to work, we have to outdo the Christians in compassion. They actually will take care of children that aren't their own, he says. So,
I found one that says,
these impious Galileans, meaning Christians, not only feed their own poor, but ours also. Welcoming them into their meals, they attract them as children are attracted with cakes.
That was the quote. He's writing to a pagan high priest who's supposed to be on his side, helping to reconvert the empire to paganism. And he's saying, if this is going to work, we have to do better than they do. And this is how good they are. So you have this, you have this pagan who himself acknowledges how good the Christians are doing in reaching out in love. Is that kind of, so that's going to be right around this 360 time.
Mary Holt's going to read it in the degree.
Okay. There needs to be an interpretation after the tongues happen, but.
Spanish, maybe.
Sorry?
She'll read it in Spanish.
This is what it's going to be for 8 weeks. This is going to be a free-for-all. So. We're not worrying about this. This is the divisions of the empire under Diocletian. So you see Galerius is one area. Constantine is another area. And it's going to be these two guys, this civil war that breaks out, is what's going to lead to Constantine's ascension, his eventual kind of taking over things, ruling and reigning. I remember we talked at our last time about what are we even supposed to think about Constantine. I don't know. Some of the questions. So his mother, Helena, a Christian, is this exploiting Christianity for the sake of power? Possibly. Might be a true conversion. One of the things that people who don't like the idea of Constantine truly having converted point out is that he did not get baptized to the very end of his life. That could be true, but guess what? There were a lot of people doing it because the church wasn't sure what it thought about post-baptismal sin. And the book of Hebrews talks about some things where it's like, so if you come and you accept this, what grace is left for you? So because of that, there was some confusion in the church. So does Constantine wait till his last breaths before he gets baptized? Absolutely. Might that mean he really wasn't a Christian? Perhaps it does. But there were loads of people back then who were waiting because there was this fear that if you did it too soon and sinned, you just screwed up everything and now there's no hope. So maybe it was just, he was just one of the crowd that had this kind of weird idea of what baptism did and accomplished. He talks about the unconquered sun. That was one of the things that Diocletian introduced, S-U-N. Is he merging the S-O-N and the S-U-N together? Some would say yes, some would say no. Is he a sincere convert who used Christianity for his own purposes? The whole idea of Christendom, the idea that Christianity is an integral part of culture. We live now in a post-Christendom world. But I grew up in a Christendom world. Like, I remember, I've shared with a number of you before, I remember as a young person going to a church where we hadn't heard the gospel. My entire family had the flu. I was fine. It was Sunday morning, you just go to church. I got myself up, got dressed, walked to church about a mile away. Never let my kids do that today. But I was probably about 8, 9 years old. My great aunts and uncles drove me home after. I sat with them during church. Why? It wasn't because Jesus was calling me. It wasn't trying to please God. It's just what you did. It was Sunday morning. You went to church. That is not the case anymore. We are certainly in a post-Christendom culture. The number one kind of poster child of this is, what's her name? She's a B-list comedian, red hair. She held up the...
Kathy Griffin?
Yes. She won an Emmy for something. I can't even understand what, but... she got up there and said, a lot of people come up here and thank God for these kind of honors. I want to tell you, Jesus had nothing to do with this. In fact, this is my God now. Jesus, you can suck it. Now, A, to say that, to feel free to say that, B, for that to be aired on national television, if you don't know that we're in a post-Christian culture at this point, we are, folks. We are not the dominant religion anymore. The nuns are the dominant religion. The ones who don't claim any kind of religious affiliation are the dominant group. So Christendom really begins with Constantine. It has died not that long ago. We kind of talked about that. Some of the things, Edict Milan, Sunday actually becomes a legal holiday. You want to know why like businesses used to not be open? It's only been around for 1,700 years. started with Constantine. Sunday, the first day of the week, was a holiday. Bishops actually get authority of civil judges. Bishops are actually ruling on justice issues. That's temporal power and secular and sacred power kind of holding hands. I'm not going to worry about that. Yeah. Well, I guess we'll talk about Donatism now. So here's one of the problems that we had, and this is a recurring problem. It happened 100 years before with a guy by the name of Novatian. But now when we get to the time of Augustine, one of the people he's fighting against are the Donatists. The Donatists are rigorists. What am I saying? So during times of persecution, there are people who are called traditores, traitors. That actually means to hand something over. So the traditores are the people who handed over the Bibles to the Romans so that they would be burned. And you can't go buy another one at the store. This is a sacred kind of... It took us a long time to get that, and all of a sudden it's gone forever. This was a big deal. So there were people who lapsed under the persecution. They were weak. They gave up people. They gave up the books. They gave up things. So you had the lapsed, those who kind of gave it up because it was hard. You had the martyrs, who were people who died for the faith. Then you had the confessors in the middle who survived the persecution, but as far as we know, remained faithful. Who knows what actually happened in the torture chambers, whether they gave things up or not. That's, you don't really know those things. But so the martyrs, confessors, and the lapsed. And the Donatists were the ones who, some of them were confessors, some of them weren't. But they were of the conviction that if you were a priest and you lapsed during a time of persecution, your sacraments don't work anymore. You can do all the stuff you want, say the right words, use the right elements, you can do, but if you gave it up during persecution, the magic doesn't happen. And so Augustine and a number of other people are fighting against this rigorism. It's a high-class legalism that basically says the purity of the bride, like it is our responsibility to preserve the purity of the church, more or less. This is a weird thing. Like, there's a part of me that's like, I'm with the Donatists. It would seem like you wouldn't want a satanic priest to be able to preside over communion, right? I mean, there's just like something wrong about that. But on the other hand, if it's an issue of the priest presiding being holy enough, well, who's going to preside over communion? You're never getting communion from me if it's a matter of the holiness of the priest. So Augustine is going to be railing against the Donatists over and over and over again, because of their position. They keep wanting to, they keep trying to exert influence for a while. They eventually try to leave the church, all kinds of stuff. Because of Constantine, up through about the 380s or 90s, Augustine is very conciliatory to the Donatists. He's trying to help them. You can see in some of the writings where he's compromising with them to try to kind of bring them back into the church. But by the time we get to the 400s, he has an epiphany that when Jesus talks in Luke 14 about that parable of the wedding banquet, and Jesus the host says, "Go out and compel them to come in." The guests that were supposed to be there and for whatever reason weren't. Go out and compel them to come in. He understands Luke 14 to be justification for temporal violence against the Donatists. Because he's compelling them to come in to the church. We've tried for 20 years to offer reconciliation, to bring them in. And now it's time to compel them to come in. And so this is actually all the same time. So the same time Theodosius is getting ready to do his stuff, just as Augustine is getting ready to die, he kind of has this, right around 400 or so, he takes a turn and he thinks that it's okay for the temporal powers to be used against what seem to be heretics, or at least those on the outside of the church. Questions, comments so far? We'll say more things. I say more things.
So during all this, who kept the thread of asking for personal forgiveness, forgetting about the sacraments and works to justify yourself?
There's an ongoing thread that occurs. If I don't come back to what you said, bring me back. But in my mind, what I'm about to say is connected, but it might not really be connected. As we look at those accounts back then, the people that were typically most merciful with the lapsed were the confessors. The ones who survived the persecution and knew how hard it was to keep the faith. They're the ones who typically said, "Give them some mercy. They can come back." Sometimes, some of them would take a little more tough position. They would say they're still part of the church, but they can't preside over the elements anymore. But never, I can't think of any instance where the confessors were saying that person's out of the church from here on out, where there were a lot of Donatists and Novatians and folks that were saying that. So there are these people that are close to the Lord and understand this. In my personal opinion, Augustine was this great, brilliant mind, and like, who am I, this puny little stupid guy to like rail against him? But we have relied too much on Augustine, in my opinion. We have been influenced more than he probably deserved. The guy was a sex fiend. There's no question about it. He was an addict in some way. I guess since we're there, we might as well go there, right? He had a concubine for 9 years and had a child to the woman, wouldn't marry her. After some pressure from his mom, he agrees to an arranged marriage because it's a move up in the social status. He actually gets engaged to a 10-year-old girl, of someone of higher social status. As a result of that, the concubine, the mother of his child, is sent back to Africa with the child. He never sees her again. He does have a mistress, though, because this 10-year-old is not going to be appropriate. So he has a mistress on top of this engagement thing. If you ever read his confessions, I mean, it's just fraught with this. The great thing about him is he's honest, I guess, you know. But when he was young, he would daydream. He was amazed at the sexual fantasies he could come up with. And there, I read once a long time ago, I wish I could find it again. Even in his old age, he talks about his struggle with lust, only now the struggle with lust is only in his mind. But the way he says it, it's clear that the body parts aren't working like they used to, but the struggle hasn't gone away. But once he comes to Christ, he becomes celibate. He does give up all that stuff. So there are people who are doing their best to follow the Lord. And the thing I love is that the story of the church screams about the mercy of God and the presence of the Holy Spirit. I mean, we've had some rummies running this thing over the years. If it wasn't for God's presence with us, we should have driven this thing into the ground a long time ago. But God has been good, even though we are all profoundly messed up people. So the gospel is being proclaimed. I mean, you have people, this adoring Augustine's life is when Patrick goes to Ireland. He's giving up his freedom to go be a missionary to an unreached people group. Well, people would actually call him he was a slave originally. He escaped, but he goes back to the people who had captured him. So there are these people who get the gospel, who understand it. It's just all the other stuff that we end up doing to it that becomes problematic. I probably didn't answer your question, but I talked for 10 minutes. That counts.
So my understanding is that Augustine had a view on grace, and I think that your story is trying to give us light to his view of grace. Is that correct?
Yeah, he did. He was profoundly aware of God's grace. It was the fact that he knew how messed up he was is why he understood God's grace as well as he did. That, having said that, some of the baggage comes along with it, right? So he's going to come up. He's the guy that really starts the idea of original sin. And original sin, the condemnation that is attached to original sin gets passed along to each of us how? Through the act of sex. What are we really saying? That the act of sex is a dirty thing. And this is all because of how messed up he was when he gets to the church. It actually affects some of his theology. It's theology that we have embraced about a guy that was loved by God and a great saint, but he was a profoundly messed up individual. The difference between him and me is you don't know my stuff. So, I mean, he clearly did have this wonderful understanding of grace. One of the bigger issues, if I wanted to organize this nicely today, what I could have done is talked about the four groups of people that Augustine kind of railed against, that he fought against throughout his life. The first one would have been the Manichaeans. The Manichaeans, it's a Gnostic sect from Persia, and they believed that the material world was inherently evil. And the reason they ended up, they're trying to figure out why do bad things happen to good people. Why does this happen? Because we are actually spiritual beings, and the material world is bad. So as long as we're trapped in this material world, bad things are going to happen. And Augustine, early on in his life, he's actually a Manichaean. He spends 10 years as a Manichaean. This sect, this first group of people, he's going to spend so much ink, so much energy railing against once he becomes a Christian. He actually was one of them early on. But he takes issue. He says, no, creation is a good thing. Creation is a good, now is it fallen? Is it trapped by sin? All that stuff, absolutely. But creation is a good thing. So one of his charges against this is the grace of God that we encounter in life. That there's goodness. And another one of his statements against the issue of evil is beauty. He comes to it in an aesthetic way. He talks about the fullness of God that we encounter. I don't mean to short shrift like his good contributions to theology at all. If they weren't valuable, they wouldn't have lasted 2,000 years. And grace is one of them, for sure. We might as well just stay right here and keep talking like this because we have less than 10 minutes.
You have three more people?
Yeah,
the first was the mannequins?
Yeah, mannequins is one of them. Manny, M-A-N-I, was the leader of it. So that's the first group. The third group would be the Donatists. The last group that he's going to address are the atheists in the Roman Empire that are accusing the Christians for the fall of Rome. It's basically recycling Julian the Apostate, his stuff. So the whole book, The City of God, is that there are two cities. There's the city of man and the city of God. And it doesn't matter whether it's the secular world, whether it's a Christian government or a secular government, there's always a mixture of the city of God and the city of man in both, he would say. And so this had to do with his argument in the City of God is going to be that Rome fell because of the moral corruption of the people in Rome, not because of the God that we were worshiping. So the fourth group, the second group would be Pelagianism. Can't believe we're going to go to it 5 minutes ago. But Pelagius. He is a bishop in Great Britain. So, I mean, Christianity is already in Great Britain at this time. He's a bishop in Great Britain. Augustine himself is going to become the first Archbishop of Canterbury. So he actually has been in Great Britain. The head of the church in England at the time is in Kent. And so he's actually the head there for a while. But he stays in Hippo for most of his life. Pelagius is a bishop from there. Augustine didn't have much room for Pelagius. Pelagius, Augustine said, was weighed down with the porridge of the Scots. Basically said he was a drunk. Pelagius has this idea. So Augustine is going to say, we are all messed up because of original sin. You get two things from mom and dad, Adam and Eve. You are condemned to hell at the moment of your birth, and you get a sinful nature. So you get a bent towards sin, sinful nature, and you stand guilty before God at the moment of your first breath. Because of the guilt of their sin that gets passed on to you, you are guilty at the moment of your first breath. Pelagius actually is trying to say the same thing. Augustine is saying, how do we help people understand their need for salvation? Because everyone is a sinner. That's what we're trying to do here. Pelagius is saying, we can get to that same place, but we don't have to go there. And he gets the claim to be heretic, I think rightfully so, but he's not that far off. He says that our wills are free and that people could choose God if they would. So the comeback is always, so you're saying someone could, without God's grace, come to God on their own. And Pelagius would say yes, but he would have to say, but only theoretically. He would say there has never been a person that has done that, and we have no reason to expect that it ever will occur, but theoretically a person has their will free, that they could freely come and find their way to God apart from grace. So that's where he's off the rails, right? We would understand that without God first moving, this thing doesn't happen. But he's not terribly... does our will have something to do with this? Those of us on the Arminian side feel that it does. So we have Pelagianism is going to be essentially that you can choose God. And I guess it is going to be you can't choose God. Now, do anyone have a Kleenex? I don't really need my shirt sleeve, but I'm about to. I'll use my hand.
Here's one.
This is like college. Thank you. This is like college level, maybe seminary level stuff. So, if you know, in the next 5 minutes, if you want to take a nap, that's okay. I shouldn't even be starting this at this point. But so here we end up with a theological spectrum. You have Pelagianism, what's going to be called semi-Pelagianism, semi-Augustinianism and Augustinianism. You've already all take that away. Okay, so.
You're going to put this in a chart and present it next time.
It probably ought to be where we start. We'll go at it right now and then we'll pick up here, I'm sure. So, the issue is monergism, think of energy, or synergism. So monergism is one, right? How does a person get to God? In Augustinianism, it is monergistic. God is the only one that does it. You can't come to God, Christ, apart from his moving of grace. Pelagius, it's going to be also monergistic. But the only one that's necessary is the human will. It's not necessary. Well, it's all theoretical, of course. As soon as you sin, this is, Pelagius would say this is off the books. The moment you do your first sin, this doesn't apply anymore. But theoretically, someone could do this. So in Pelagianism, it's also monergistic. The only one that's necessary is you and your will. Both of the middle two are synergistic that say, God moves, and humans have to cooperate in some way. So pure Augustinianism is monergistic. God is the only one who does this. Salvation is an act of God. You don't have much to do with it. Here, we would say, it's theoretically possible I could choose God for myself. Most of us are going to be here. This is kind of the orthodox side of things. The difference between semi-Pelagianism and semi-Augustinianism is who moves first. So semi-Pelagianism is Georgia is God, and I'm doing my thing here, and I want to have a relationship with God, and I say, hi, God, I'm Rob.
Hi.
And no matter how hard I try, I can't do it. And so why? It's synergistic. So God has to move too. God then moves towards me, but I'm the one that moves first in semi-Pelagianism. God responds to this gesture that we make, this attempt that we make, this disposition that we have. Semi-Augustinian is the opposite. God first comes to us and extends the hand. And because of his grace, we then respond. So, wow. Here we are.
So is there something between the two semi?
Let's talk this week, and we'll explore that next week. I don't know. I can't think of one, but there might be.
Does the average person in the church have any clue that this is going on? at the time. I mean,
as far as how we're experiencing it, you mean?
Yeah.
Or that this debate is going on?
Well, so I would experience it if my priest were in one of the camps or not, but I wouldn't necessarily even know that there was another camp unless right. It's really popular. So is that more the case that you experience it based on the belief of whoever's leading your congregation, but it's not like being hotly debated among the general population?
General population, that's true, yes. So one of the tricks is that, I don't want to go there right now. So,
I mean, we don't know that if you hadn't told us that people were arguing about open theology, half of us would have never heard of it.
Yeah.
But it's being hotly debated.
It is. People. Yeah. It's certain levels. The levels that this is being talked about is even thinner than open theism kind of stuff. But this kind of stuff is actually in operation in a lot of our churches, and we don't even understand.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, are you among the elect? Is God predetermined this? Performed, or does your will have some place to play? There are times at which Wesleyan Arminianism falls into this, and I think when it does, it has fallen off the orthodoxy side. I mean, have you chosen Jesus? Have you accepted Jesus? We really do put a lot of emphasis on the you act. Mm-hmm. on the Wesleyan side. We don't do as much emphasis on what God is doing and has already done in it. So the Calvinist charge against Wesleyan Arminians that sometimes were semi-Pelagian, we're guilty of it sometimes. No one comes if Christ doesn't first move. Now, you don't have to experience, you don't have to know that he is first moved. I was in this church that we hadn't heard the gospel as a family yet. I couldn't be more than 6 years of age. So I came to Christ in 78, so that would have been 9. So somewhere up to the age of 9, we're in this church, having heard the gospel, because the pastor didn't believe in the bodily resurrection of Jesus, did not believe in the virgin birth of Jesus. Jesus was a good guy, you should live like Jesus. That's what we heard. I would get my mom's old Smith Corona typewriter out and type children's sermons during the week. Now, unfortunately, she still has some of those. I'm not one to open that folder. You know? Is that not God at work before I even heard the gospel? Is that not God doing things before I even had a chance to respond? I couldn't have given a yes because I hadn't heard yet. But who's sitting down? I mean, what a boring life I must have had. I'm sitting writing children's sermons. I was a child. Well, God's moving when we don't even perceive it.
Obviously an exceptional child.
I'll receive that as a gift. I don't believe it. But I yeah, special has a wide range of meaning.
The word is spatial.
Yes. Okay, well, we're 10:05. Thank you. We'll pick up here somehow next time. Maybe we'll still be on Augusta. Maybe we'll move 10 more years into the future. I don't know.
Probably.
Oh, you want to just get it since you're standing?
Sure. If you can help, we're hosting Family Promise this week, so I want to do a little setup now. What we can, and then immediately after the service to help clean this room up. So if you can do that, just come see me. Thanks.
Power that down. Yeah. Oh, I should say power down. Stop the recording.
Okay.
I want to